Recording in Los Gatos on April 11th, 2016. This is GeekSpeak, episode 15 of our 16th season. You're listening to Independent Public Radio 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz and streaming live worldwide at kosp.org. It's time now for GeekSpeak. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the Geeks affiliated organizations. Hello, I'm Lyle Troxell, your host and producer of GeekSpeak, and with me in the studio is Ben Jaffe. Hey, Ben.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, good. Right here, your tagline says teacher, world traveler, programmer, and music geek. And teacher, you used to professionally be a teacher.
I used to be a professional teacher, and not recently. I mean, now I'm an engineer at Facebook.
So, do you miss the teaching aspect?
It's interesting because I don't know. On the one hand, I don't really identify as a teacher in terms of my profession anymore, mm-hmm. because that's not my job, really.
Sure.
But I kind of do it anyway. I really like teaching. I like spreading knowledge. I like taking the things that I've learned that I find interesting and sharing them.
Two podcasts you do.
Yeah, one outlet is this, and yeah. Another outlet is the other podcast I do. I don't know. It's important, I think.
I got to say that one of the things I've noticed in teaching people is especially with computers, is this idea that I'm this sage and I have all the answers. And mm-hmm. then you're the computer guy. Yeah, they ask me questions and I take a piece of my knowledge in my brain, I pull it out and I give it to them. And in reality, most of the time, as a computer expert and programmer and all that, I do not feel like a sage. Mm-hmm. I feel like a learner. I feel like I'm constantly going, I don't know how to do this. And someone recently asked me about getting their network working again. Mm-hmm. And I didn't even know the name of the place on iOS to go to change your settings for your network.
Yeah. So you would say go to settings and look for something that maybe it's called network, maybe it's called it could be something like that. Do you see anything like that?
That's exactly right.
Right.
And I remember, you know, remote tech support sometimes take a picture of your, send me a picture so I see what you're talking about.
Right, right.
Read all the menus across the top.
And there are programs that actually help with that, that let
sure.
you see the person that you're debugging their computer and
which
you can see it.
Which is the only way to go.
Except when they have to reboot their computer and then you lose it.
But it's interesting because, of course, we are experts on computers. People do come to us and we do have an ability to figure things out quickly.
So what is that then?
Right. What is that exactly? And I guess it's I've always felt like it was the ability to figure something out, to mm-hmm. learn new things, is the crucial thing to be successful in a world where everything changes all the time.
Mm. Okay, so let's say JavaScript, right? You want to learn JavaScript. Okay, so there's some things that you just have to memorize, right? So you and I both know how to write a for loop. Mm-hmm. You and I both know the syntax and you put a semicolon at the end of every statement. Those are kind of the memorization things, but that's really not what JavaScript is.
Right.
JavaScript is I hesitate to use the word framework because that means something else in computer science,
sure.
but it's kind of like a framework or a paradigm, this thing that you can use and utilize to solve problems. Mm-hmm. And the solving problems is really what learning how to program is about.
Mm-hmm.
It's about using this programming language to solve problems. Just like I'm using English to communicate with you. To communicate in English, you don't just memorize a dictionary. You actually need to be able to utilize those words to communicate effectively. And sometimes when you're communicating difficult concepts, like how to learn things over the radio,
mm-hmm.
you need to be creative
yeah.
in the way that
we seem to on GeekSpeak quite a bit because of the radio form of teaching.
Yeah.
We use metaphor. It seems to be a great way to explain more complex ideas. In fact, almost everything we do with regarding computers is actually at some level a metaphor because what's really going, we actually understand a concept at a very low level. For example, we talk about JavaScript as a language and a way of thinking about how to solve a problem in the JavaScript language. But what really JavaScript is an interpreter that changes the language commands into machine code. And that's, I mean, I'm not going to get into details of that, but that's the actual reality, right? The language on top of that's a metaphoric way of speaking about what's really happening.
I want to take a second actually to dig into that. And, okay. And we can't go all the way down because there are a lot of levels. There are many, many more levels than either you and I can imagine. But I was having a conversation actually with a coworker of yours actually, who's a friend of mine. And we were talking about if everything computery went away, right?
Okay.
And you had to start from scratch.
New Stone Age.
And you have all of the knowledge that you currently do.
We get nowhere.
You get nowhere.
Well, because I could...
Because what you have to... Okay, now we have to make a switch. We have to start with a switch. We need to make a transistor. Okay, so we'll make a transistor.
Oh, transistors are very hard to make.
Now we've got to make these transistors smaller. And there's all of these decades and decades, people's life's work, stacked over each other and over each other. And if you wanted to do this all over again, you couldn't necessarily go faster because, for example, you'd need to build a program which is a compiler, a really, really bad compiler, to compile a program which you could write to compile a better program, to compile a better program, to compile a better program.
And you're basically
couldn't just jump.
You're basically just telling the story of how we have these more rich application programming languages like JavaScript, compiler, right? But even, I mean, at even lower level, of course, there's the transistor. That's going to be hard fought. Mm-hmm. But I think if we had all the books that we currently have and society crashed and we had to rebuild, that'd be a very different scenario than not having those books.
That's true. That's true. But just the knowledge in our head, I mean...
How did we get down this rabbit hole?
Oh, so we were... How did we? We were talking about how everything is a metaphor.
Okay, yeah.
So like when you press... Let's say you say, okay, type your password. Well, what's really happening there? You know, like when you press one key on your keyboard, what seems like an infinite amount of different things at smaller and smaller, more basic levels happen. And no one human on earth understands even a fraction of all of it.
Yeah.
So really, all of everything we do on computers is metaphors on top of metaphors on top of metaphors.
I mean, we can kind of say
even
that
programming.
We can kind of say the language in general. If you can think of a language as an accepted understanding of vocabulary, an accepted understanding of complex issues and complex ideas.
Right.
So all that to some degree is metaphoric. But we won't let's not drown down that because I want to talk about
that's a long rabbit hole.
People learning. And how to, like I touched on earlier, this idea that the skill that makes you the most successful as being an engineer is the ability to learn quickly.
To figure things out.
Because no time is technology standing still.
Right.
You brought up JavaScript, for example, and having a memory of like how to do a for loop in JavaScript. You're right that I totally know how to do a for loop in JavaScript because I've been doing JavaScript for so long.
But you don't do for loops very often.
No, it's not. I don't. but it's been like 6 months since I was doing full time JavaScript. I've been doing iOS development with Objective-C.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And so for me, I guess JavaScript will probably be with me forever because I'm so familiar with it. But I would say that. What's more important about JavaScript is that there's this great website that has all the methods declared, right?
Yeah, documentation.
Documentation.
It's a website that sums up all the documentation in JavaScript in an easy to consume way for humans.
Do you use Mozilla's
MDN? Yeah, MDN, Mozilla Developer Network.
Yeah, it's a great resource. It's so funny. As what was that one that was really bad for JavaScript?
W3 Schools.
W3 Schools. It was so bad.
It's not as bad anymore, but I still boycott them.
It used to be bad, and they always had the highest search results. So Google, if you search for something, they'd be at the top. And I remember every time I'd click the, even though the answer is normally in the search results when you search correctly for a JavaScript question, you can see it. I'd always click on the MDM Mozilla Developer Network.
As your own form
of a way of voting it up. And it slowly is a... Because actually, Google search results actually change their value based on the use of people. So if someone's searching for a phrase and one website comes up, but no one actually stops searching at that point, they keep on going to other pages, the other pages get higher ranks. So the actual use of the search engine actually change results.
So coming back... you wouldn't be worried about forgetting things in JavaScript you have this resource. You have this documentation. And you have also this other thing that we don't talk about very often, but it's like built into you, is that you have practiced learning things and figuring things out.
Right.
And that is really the skill that I guess if you have a good interviewer and you're interviewing for a programming job, what they're really looking for is not whether you remember what array.prototype.map does. They're looking for your ability to like think on a bit of a higher level and use tools to figure things out. So you could say like, "Oh, I know I want to I want to go over everything in this array and then do this, right? I don't remember what the method for that is." Your interviewer probably shouldn't dock all that many points for that. But if you instead are reciting kind of memorized formulas or something, that's the red flag for the interviewer.
Actually, knowing all that stuff perfectly is a red flag for you?
Yeah.
Are you saying that?
I'm not saying that because some people have much better memories than me.
Right.
And so I wouldn't want to dock someone with a really, really good memory who remembers all of that stuff really well. But if I'm interviewing somebody, I'm looking for a deeper understanding, an understanding past the particular APIs of the language or the framework or whether they know React.js really well. I'm looking for an ability to think, I guess, on a bigger level about what you're doing with the tools rather than knowing how to use each one of the tools exactly right. Mm-hmm. And you want that in someone who's, for example, building a building or it doesn't matter if they know all the tools. If they don't know how to put those tools to use and those materials to use to create something that's really structurally sound that you might be able to build another floor on later on, yeah. That's the important part when you're choosing an architect.
Okay, so you are a professionally teacher and you're focused mostly on younger people, right? High school,
half and half, yeah.
Half and half, okay.
I taught a summer camp, which was really fun.
Which was the younger, the 8-year-olds?
I taught for several years at a company called Digital Media Academy. Mm-hmm. I also taught at a company called Academy X, which was more working professionals.
Okay. Oh, so you did mm-hmm. do working professionals. When you were teaching working professionals, were you enhancing their already existing skills or were you teaching people that didn't have any idea of the space just to have a better to have a better understanding of the space?
It's, I guess for me, it's so curriculum, mm-hmm. which I was given to use. Curriculum tends to focus on the tools, right?
Right.
This is how you do this. This is how you do that. And that isn't really at the crux of it. It's important to have a familiarity with the tools, though. So I would kind of follow the documentation in that way. But I would also deviate from the documentation or from the curriculum quite a bit because I was trying to teach a bigger picture. And one of the best ways as a teacher, I think, to get that across is not just to teach them the what, but the why, mm-hmm. right? Not just the what and the how you do something, but why are you doing this in the first place? Like, why do you need to know about this? Mm-hmm. What are some situations in which you might use it? What are some unusual situations in which sure. you might use it? You're kind of giving the person a lot of context for this thing that you're trying to put into their head. And the context is really the ability to think critically between those two things is really what you're after.
Yeah. I agree that is
you can't
the
teach
important
it directly.
Piece. Yeah. I'm trying to think of like my experience working at Netflix the last 2.5 years has been
has it been that long? Oh my gosh. Is that true?
I think it has. Past 2 Decembers. Maybe it's been 2.5 years, December of
2 1/3 years.
2 1/3 years? Okay, sure. Mm-hmm. I'm not a mathematician. So
yeah, you don't necessarily need to know math super well to be a good programmer.
I'm kind of joking because my math's okay, but yeah, my calendar conversion, I guess, is not so great. In any case,
if you're writing a calendar conversion library, you're probably doing something
you're
wrong.
You're doing something wrong, yeah.
Get a library. One that already exists.
Definitely. So, but in the last 2 years, becoming a full-time programmer again, which I hadn't done since like 2000, I was working in education. I was teaching
stuff, that's right.
For like 11 years, I was teaching grad level stuff about technology. And switching back into being a full-time developer has made me, or software engineer, has made me keenly aware of how much you have to learn continuously. Like when I first mm-hmm. came aboard, I was like, okay, I know JavaScript well, but 3 or 4 months and then I was like, okay, I feel comfortable again. As my full-time thought. Like I can mm-hmm. very quickly take an array and transform it into anything I want easily
right.
without
but that
even thinking about it.
Took a couple months.
Right? Took a few months, right? Even though yeah. I was a pretty good expert, I got hired at least, right?
Right.
And then since then, I don't think I've ever gone feeling like I was not learning the entire time. Mm-hmm. Like I think that pretty much every day I am engaged in new ways of thinking about some problem. And I think that has to do with the complexity set that arises around software.
Hmm.
But it's probably the case in most fields, I would assume in some fields. If you take like a writer, I mean, I'm assuming that they are, as they're writing, you know, even something they're making up completely in their mind, they are bringing new ideas and new things emerge from those ideas.
Right.
Just because you spend a lot of time thinking.
Yeah. What do you mean? You said the complexity set. What do you mean by that?
I strongly feel that the tools that we have for software development are designed for human brains to produce highly complex but stable systems.
Mm-hmm, right.
And all our software engineering development discussions and ideas, object-oriented this or purely functional, those mm-hmm. concepts are about making it possible for us to comprehend complex systems.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a software engineer, if you don't understand something, what's going on, you have to get to a point where you understand it. But of course, you have to understand it. You have to come up with another language to then understand.
Mm-hmm.
We work a lot.
So yeah, you've got what's his name, Cypher in the Matrix, staring at the screen with ones and zeros. Like, that doesn't work with humans. Humans can't
exactly.
look at a bunch of ones and zeros
exactly.
and like lock onto, oh, that's a sentence, or oh, that's some binary information, or that's a JPEG.
But a second ago, when I said to you purely functional programming, you understood what that meant and
yeah,
what I meant by that, and you know. Of course, we're not going to necessarily get into that, but the idea behind that concept mm-hmm. versus an object-oriented structure, not that they're diametric by any means, but they
sure.
both have concepts that are useful in discussion. If you and I are talking about a problem and I start using the lingua franca of functional programming and we're in that space, there's
a
certain way to communicate.
Language.
Yeah.
Okay, so...
And that's why I mean problem set, like or problem scope, whatever I was said before.
Yeah.
The idea is that there's a rich mindscape that you have to understand to then be able to think in that space.
And that's
what engineering is for me. It's
sometimes that's really hard to come by.
Yeah.
So at work, I am working with a library. It's basically a big chunk of code which does some stuff. And I...
Come on. What do you do at Facebook? Be more specific. Because the worst part of this conversation is we're not like having real like example-y stuff.
Right.
So can you be example-y stuff?
Hold on. I'm trying to... I need to remember what I was going to say.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, no. You
were saying you have this large library.
Okay. Yeah. So how do you... Okay. If you have this... And actually, I'm not going to be specific because I think it actually would be easier to talk
okay.
about.
Abstract.
If you have this chunk of code that does some stuff, you didn't write this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Someone else wrote it. And you are being asked to, or maybe you are asking yourself to, you want to do something. And that chunk of code seems to do something like what you want to do. And so you want to use that chunk of code, right?
Ooh, this is great. Okay. Right there is so much about what software engineering
right.
is. You kind
You're
of
at that
understand
moment.
That you kind of have a space that's supposed to do what you need, and mm-hmm. now you have to figure out how to use it.
Yep. I know I need to move things around the screen. So I guess I need a library that does like – that lets me – do DOM stuff, maybe. Mm-hmm. Are there – what libraries like that? Okay, jQuery. jQuery is a great library for that. It does DOM manipulation, among other things. jQuery is a very widely used library.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go online, you can find – first of all, you can find a great documentation page that a bunch of people have written up, probably partially programmatically generated, partially a whole bunch of people like manipulating this documentation. So it's really optimized for getting in, figuring out how to do something and getting back out. In addition to that, the code is nice and clean.
Sure.
You can go in, you can read it if you need to. You probably don't need to. In addition, all these people, other people, like thousands of other developers use jQuery, and so you can search for a problem. And you find someone who's had this exact same problem.
Mm-hmm.
And you figure out all these different solutions because people have all chimed in. So that's not what I'm talking about.
Okay, so that example is a library that handles a problem, has a pretty clear idea of what the problem scope is. It's for web pages, basically.
Right.
And lots of people use it, and there's lots of examples of it.
So you want me to jump in and learn that? That's fine.
Not right? that hard to do, sure.
Yeah. But the situation I'm in at work is there's this code. Someone else wrote it. Actually, they're still working on it, and it's mm-hmm. changing. Luckily, I can ask them questions. But there's no real documentation, right?
And no one else is really using it.
The code may not necessarily be clean. I'm lucky in this case that it's fairly clean, but it may be kind of a mess. So if I want to learn how to do a particular thing, how to use a method or a function or something like that, there's no documentation. So I actually have to read the code itself and figure out what it does.
So let's say this application paints color. So sure. You can it has some ideas of how to paint. So you want to paint some red with a green stripe. So right. You're going to look through this thing to try to figure out how to do that.
Fine. Fill rect. What does that do?
Maybe right. It makes and you kind of know rect, from other experience rectangle. That rect is rectangles and how to do it. Yeah, right.
Right. So, okay, I'm going to fill a big red rectangle and then I guess I want to draw a green thing over it. So what kind of things, what I mean, is there a draw line or something?
How do you attack that problem?
How do you attack that problem? That's a really good question. Well, and that's where I am. And let's talk about that in a second.
You're listening to Geek Speak on Independent Public Radio, KOSP. I'm Lyle Troxell. I'm with Ben Jaffe. And we'll find out how do we attack that problem in just a second. Stick with us. This is Geek Speak on KOSP. If you'd like to participate in the conversation, you're welcome to do so by sending us an email, geeks@geekspeak.org, or we're on Twitter and Facebook. We're KOSP Geeks. I'm Lyle Troxell. Ben, you're talking about complex problems of applications or of libraries you don't know exactly. You know it kind of mm-hmm. can do things like fill color. How do you actually figure out what you need to do next?
Right. And actually, there's one more element to this that I just want to put out there before we talk about how either of us mm-hmm. Attack this. Not only do you have to read the code to figure out what this method does or what this thing does.
Kind of backwards engineer.
But you can't step back from it and get a high-level concept, right? You can't step back from this library and say this library does this kind of a thing in this way. This is how it organizes itself. These are the kinds of objects you would expect to work with. That's very easy with something like underscore Lodash or jQuery, where they're all very well defined and they've got good documentation. Or React. There are so many blog posts that have been written, as well as documentation on their page of what's the paradigm here.
So what you're talking about is that you're talking about a complicated library that in other examples like React and all these other things you're mentioning mm-hmm. are so public and so well documented that the complexity is the same between this unknown one and these mm-hmm. these broad ones. But these broad ones have a lot of discussion around them, a lot of dialogue, a lot of language definitions and. Because of that, they're easy to start cold. Mm-hmm. In the library situation where you can't even look at a broad view of this thing because you have to dive into every little tiny step and kind of trace it backwards.
Right.
It's not the same kind of learn. Yeah.
It's hard to tackle.
What do you feel like when you have to tackle something like that?
I'm glad you asked it that way. I feel at first I feel frustration. Mm-hmm. Then I feel a little bit of self-loathing because it's really easy. It's really easy as an engineer, an engineer in Silicon Valley, there's a very high quality of work that people expect from you,
sure.
right? And so it's
you're
very
paid well, right? You're an expert,
yeah, paid well. Work at Facebook or Netflix for you. it's very easy to fall into this pit of imposter syndrome, mm-hmm. where you feel like, oh God, I feel like I'm slower than everyone else. I'm not seeing anyone else struggling with this stuff. Plot twist, they all are. But you don't see it. You don't see it. You see yourself. You feel all of the frustrations that you're going through. And actually, the things that are most useful to me are a reminder to myself to be patient with myself and self-acceptance. Because when you're struggling with a problem like this, it's very, very easy to go for days just hammering away at this and you feel like you get nowhere.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, absolutely.
Now, you probably aren't getting nowhere. You're probably getting somewhere because you're getting exposure to the code. You're getting exposure to the function and method.
You're learning.
Names. You're learning. You might not be able to see it necessarily, but it's happening in your head. And at some moment, there's going to be a moment where something clicks a little bit.
Yeah.
Maybe not entirely, but maybe it clicks to 20%. Now you've got 20%. Now it's a lot easier. You've got something to push off of, and you can build off of that.
With regards to the imposter syndrome, I think one of the reasons this is so challenging is we work in these environments where all of these really smart people are writing software, and it's complicated and hard, mm-hmm. and takes a long time to learn.
Especially everyone's smarter.
Sometimes
than you,
get blocked, right? And then regularly, you get a pull request. Now, this is somebody else has made changes to code, and they've spent a lot of time on it or whatever, and they've asked you to review it to see if they've made any mistakes. And this is how you collaboratively work on things. These are things called pull requests.
Right. So I do a bunch of work, and then rather than just committing it I mean, that's called YOLO. That's a really bad idea.
Right, right.
I say, hey, Lyle, you kind of know something about this graphics stuff. Can you look at my code and see, just as a sanity check, what have I missed?
And it does two things. What it does is allows somebody else to look at it and go, does this make sense or not? Which is really important because at some point, even the writer won't remember what they wrote. And so being able to look at it and figure it out is extremely important in software engineering. So I'll look at the pull request, and that's the thing is, in that pull request is not the hours and hours of struggle and strife that Ben tried to figure out how to draw friggin' red and green.
Right.
Instead, it's a perfect answer that works. He knows it works because he actually wrote a test or he ran it and it actually functioned. So I'm looking at something that works already, and it looks, you know, it might be really complicated and rich in ideas and thoughts because you put hours and hours in it, and I can review it in a few minutes. And that right there makes me feel pretty stupid.
Oh, like, yeah.
What's Ben doing here? This is insane. Oh, that's so smart. Oh, my gosh. But when you look at your own stuff, even though you spent a long time on it, when you finally submit it, it doesn't feel like it's the answer. It feels like it's the solution that you came to after a lot of strife.
It feels like a answer.
Yeah.
And gosh, what if I had done it better? I could have done it faster, right?
Right.
All that stuff.
And I have to say that sometimes when I look back at a problem that I haven't solved in a long time, that was something I solved, I then can recognize, oh, that was clever. Mm-hmm. But when I've done it myself, I don't normally feel that way. Normally I feel like, oh, I got
you're
through that
close.
One.
You're too close to it.
Yeah.
You're just way too close to it.
You know, speaking of how you feel up and down on like having to have patience and self-acceptance, but also feeling like maybe you're not good enough kind of thing, I have the peaks and valleys of this constantly with engineering. You know, I'm well-reviewed by my colleagues as I know what I'm doing. At the same time, some days I come home and feel like I don't know what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a constant thing that now I just start accepting, oh, I'm just in that phase right now.
Right.
In a few days, I'll be
so
like.
So after 2.5 years two and a third years, that's – sorry. I'm not going to rub that in. I mean, you know, I've been at my job, at my new job for 3 months and a couple days or something. but yeah, it's eventually it's a pattern you see as an engineer. Now, when you're learning – you don't have that luxury. You don't know what your peaks and troughs and the fact that this is a pattern, you don't see that.
Right.
And so, gosh, it really sucks to learn something like this, right? Because there's so much to it. There's so much in that, right? Like if you're, let's say you're learning JavaScript. Let's say you want to learn JavaScript and become a front-end web developer or something like what? That's the path I ended up going on.
A front-end web developer means the front of the website. When you go to a website and you look at stuff, what
you
see and how that interacts, like reading Gmail or something, that whole thing is a front-end application.
Right.
And it's written in JavaScript.
Right, right. So when you want to learn JavaScript, you I don't know. It's really, really hard. It's also very it's often dissatisfying the progress that you're making because you feel like you're not making much, right? You actually are.
Yeah.
But it doesn't feel that way. And it takes a long time before you can see that. So I guess as a teacher, I think the most important thing as a teacher that I was ever able to try to provide was a sense of reassurance and also a sense giving some context, right?
But also
so like the context of this is really, really hard and no, you're not alone.
This is
what I went through. Like, I mean, I guess I try to make myself vulnerable in those sessions too and put my experience and my journey out there rather than I'm the person, the expert on the mountain. I'm doling out knowledge.
The sage.
Yeah, no, like everyone started from zero at some point. And so
I think the other thing that you also did in those classes is made a curriculum with small steps.
Right,
I mean, we were talking earlier before the show about the idea of learning how to play guitar. You could take a guitar and see someone like Hendrix playing and just try to copy them, right? That's one way to learn a guitar.
That'd be really, really hard.
It would probably take a long time before you could do anything successfully. Or you could take a path where you slowly learn how to do your chords and you learn how to do all the steps necessary to kind of make simple scales and all those
you
things
build it up.
Which are introductory, which you kind of need to be taught. It's not really playing music. It's teaching you the skills to play music. And that path is much easier to learn. It's slower in the sense that you're not going to be playing a song, the song of Hendrix's song right away.
Yeah.
But you'll have a skill set that you can then build off of and be flexible.
There's a word for that, actually.
What
it's the zone of proximal development.
You nerd.
It's the idea that I'm here. I'm at at this point, right? And I want to go all the way over there. In my learning. If I try and just make that leap, I'm going to fail. And not only am I going to fail, I'm going to come out of it worse off because I'm going to be so...
Right.
I'm going to shut down. I'm going to get overwhelmed and shut down. Same thing with learning anything, whether it's music or learning to code or learning to pretty much anything. If you go past, I imagine it's like a circle around you. These are all the things that I'm able to learn without getting overwhelmed. You want to get close to the edge of that circle without stepping over the line.
You almost want a little bit of failure to help you learn, but not enough to make it feel like you're not progressing.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
Duolingo. Have you ever used the app Duolingo?
I have. It's the language one, right?
Yeah. It's a crowdsourced language learning app. I highly recommend it. I believe it's free all over the place. It's amazing. And basically you say, well, now I want to learn French. And it shows you pictures and words. And over time, it's like a game where you slowly learn it. And it almost feels like you're not progressing very fast because it's like, mm-hmm. yeah, okay, palm. Yeah, I know it's an apple, whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, but eventually yeah. you're like, oh, I knew that. I know how to say femme. Uh-huh. And you know, you start knowing the language because you failed slightly but had enough success to keep you going.
I love that moment where you think, okay, I know how to say apple. I know how to say banana. I know how to say I am. And now I know how to say I am a banana. Like, that's exciting. Now, that's a little...
You are skinny, but 90s you don't look
joke.
Like a banana.
No, it's a little 90s joke.
I don't get the joke.
It's the rejected cartoons. The banana walks in. Dunk, 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 dunk. I am a banana. Anyway, someone out there is laughing at my joke, and the rest
okay,
of you
I'm glad someone
are just looking at, like, who is this Ben guy? Anyway, but you get to that moment where you have all these individual pieces, and all of a sudden you're like, what? I know how
I
to put them
things.
Together.
Yeah.
Like, I can ask where the bathroom is.
Yeah.
I can order a burrito or whatever it is.
You know, I spoke about working at UCSC and in grad school and teaching people. There was this class that was extremely hard to get success on. And that was Introduction to Programming for Artists.
Mm.
So you'd come in and there'd be somebody that had a lot of theater experience with lighting or something. Or another person would be an actor potentially. Or another person was a painter or a sculptor. And these people with high density skills, lots of knowledge in, you know, this is a grad program, so a lot of knowledge in art history.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
sometimes even
digital
art history.
People.
Yeah, accomplished people, videographers. And then you'd sit them down and go, okay, let's teach you like the basics to programming. And the way that I learned basic programming was through electronics, right? So if you want to get basics, you can talk about the transistor and how you do binary.
Uh-huh.
Well, that gets pretty dry pretty quick. And so, well, we can't do that. So now
Wait, one quick question. Was it dry for you?
No, I always find things fascinating. You know, I like to talk.
Right.
But was it
No, when you learned it.
No, electronics was
when you
great.
Were learning about like binary. I mean, were you learning it about as binary or were you just poking at things and figuring out.
I did my undergraduate or my associate's degree
that's
in electronics.
Right.
So
that's right.
I had to learn how to, you know, electronics, how to set up 8080 processors and program them and stuff and bias transistors and the whole deal. So I learned programming after I did those things. So
oh, really?
Oh, yeah. So that – and you didn't do that, right? You didn't have that level of electronics first.
I learned programming on my TI-83 Plus graphing calculator Spanish class when I was supposed to be learning a different language, and that's why my Spanish is so bad.
So
that thing didn't have a manual.
And if I said to our Introduction to Artists, hey, you're going to learn to program. Here's a TI computer.
Right.
You know, that'd be insane.
Yeah.
So we have all these people that are experts in computers that have kind of self-taught or came through different disciplines, and those potentially are the teachers of how to learn programming.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, at this point, the complexity set that you and I have around programming is not a one-semester course.
No.
Right?
No.
So even a getting introduction, this is a general thing when people talk to me about, like, how do I learn how to program? I don't even know where they should start. I don't know. I don't think a 101, introduction to programming course is a good course normally. So I'm scared of that.
Yeah.
I normally show them how to view source and change a web page.
So here's a thought. You were saying... you wouldn't just hand them a TI-83 Plus. First of all, you wouldn't want to use a TI-83 Plus calculator. But you want to give them something else, like processing or something.
Mm-hmm.
But you might give a person who wants to be a sculptor a hunk of clay and say, go. I mean, that's kind of a way to keep in mind.
Almost all humans have had, depending on their age, that many years playing with their hands and squishing things.
Right.
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 So
A paintbrush, right? Paintbrush and some watercolor stuff, and you say, okay, go. Just draw something beautiful. You don't have to draw something that's recognizable. Just draw something beautiful. Have fun, you know, like play with shapes and lines and everything. That's the way I learned to code,
mm-hmm.
was by playing in this little world, right?
Yeah. And if you want to be alone for hours and hours fiddling with a computer, you will learn to program.
Oh, yeah, definitely. That's definitely true.
I just think that the people that have spent all the time in their early life playing on a computer and then they become this like computer geek like we were and mm-hmm. are, and then they go into programming, that's great. There's nothing wrong with that.
That's
wonderful. We
that's
want
easy.
People like that. But then there are people that are thinking a completely different way. That are my mother's a great example. She's an oil painter and watercolor painter, and really quite amazing with a paintbrush. Right, years of study in that, and she thinks about the world and color and interaction completely different than someone like me.
She thinks through her paradigm,
right,
through her method,
and yet our entire world of interaction and communication is growing rapidly in the space where my mother's not a part of it,
mm-hmm.
and that means that we're lacking something. You as a Facebook developer and me as a Netflix developer, we are not doing what my mother would do if she had the skill set we do, and we're not writing and creating things that work potentially as successfully as something that she would potentially create, mm-hmm. that space. So, and this is all about diversity, right? We don't have gender, and we don't have race diversity in Silicon Valley, but we also don't have thought diversity, mm-hmm. from an engineering, mm-hmm. perspective, and that's why we need to partner up with designers and such. But I really feel like there's
more diverse viewpoints into that world of
that's right. And I think that barrier of traditional computer science engineer people teaching intro to programming puts a really big wall up for
uh-huh,
that.
Uh-huh.
And it's true that it's hard to talk about programming without thinking about variables, and therefore there's a conceptual idea that there's algebra going on. Like that kind of concept, mm-hmm. is a little off-putting, but I feel like we're at a space where relatively – I'm hoping that barrier breaks down.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what that's going to look like. Maybe it's going to look like more AI helping. But in any case,
I don't know. It's fun stuff.
Should we cover some weekend geek news kind of things?
Oh yeah,
let's do that.
Let's get started.
You got this great blissfully happy. What's this about?
Oh yeah, this one actually. I if it could cross my mind, I would have wanted to talk about it before I saw that there was actually a study done on this. This is done at the University of Minnesota, and it's talking about how people will interpret emoji differently.
Emoji, of course, is the pictures that are in text messages.
Yeah, a little smiley face. That's
right.
An emoji. There are a lot more. There's a little
but these are not
a snake.
This is not like a colon and a parenthesis next to each other to make a smiley face. This is the translation
this
of that
is the
into
actual
an actual
thing.
Image.
Yeah, so when you type colon and parenthesis and it turns into a smiling face, that smiling face is actually a character, just like the letter A is a character.
It's a part of a Unicode spec,
mm-hmm.
and actually specifies what that character should look like. But it's text description specification.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's exciting. So
so then like we're talking about like – So you
example,
you told me a story about an experience you had with a friend.
Oh, yeah. I'll tell you that.
Okay.
First, I want to talk about briefly what you mean by it's a text description spec. So for U+1F601, which is a picture of this face that looks really, really happy, the spec, the Unicode standard says, quote, grinning face with smiling eyes. That's the spec. The spec
yes.
is not a picture of this smiling face. It's the text description. And so when Google goes and draws their emoji, and when Facebook goes and draws their emoji, and Samsung and Nokia and Apple, they all their artists interpret this slightly differently.
Okay,
and
specifically,
that's the key.
Grimming face with smiling eyes was part – oh, now I can't find which spec number. I think it's –
it's
see.
The Unicode standard.
Which one is it?
I don't know what the official one is.
Emoji. Okay, so here is the description. A version of the grinning face, which looks closer to a grimacing face on many platforms. Those are also the descriptions.
Uh-huh.
Due to the popularity of the Apple emoji artwork, this is commonly used as a grimacing face instead of a grinning smiling face with smiling eyes. Google and Microsoft's artwork for the emoji most closely represents how this should be represented on all platforms.
Yeah, because it looks like a happy face.
So Apple did it one way, and they did it a different way, and the spec is now kind of discussing it. There's Emojipedia, by the way, .org. Emojipedia. Emojipedia, if you want to learn all about these things, they're awesome.
So I had an experience. This bit me recently. I sent this particular emoji. This is a fairly popular emoji. It's one of the – so on Facebook Messenger, which I use quite a bit, you can change the little thumbs up emoji. A lot of people don't know this, but you can click the little drop down and click change emoji, and you can change the default emoji. So by default, you click the little thumbs up thing that's always
the
sitting
like,
there.
The like.
That's the like. You can change it to a heart or to a fire or to a sun.
These represent different things, right? Facebook added this like in the last 6 months.
I'm not sure when they added it, but yeah, it's basically emoji that's a one particular emoji that's really, really accessible. So for my partner, it's a heart, right? And for my mom, I don't know, with my friend, I think it's the little smiling pile of poo because it's fun. So I set it to this purple – it's this purple face with kind of the eyebrows a little bit frowny. It kind of looks a little bit like an evil purple face, which is grinning.
Does it have ears?
Here's
the imp and smiling face with horns.
Is that –
those are the two purple ones.
Oh, yeah. It's smiling face with horns.
Smiling face with horns.
I think it is.
All right.
But in any case –
I love that we're talking about this on a radio show.
Right. So it's this purple smiling face. So I sent it to my friend, and maybe we'll find out what happens.
That's great.
Okay. In just a second.
This is Geekspeak. We'll be right back. We'll find out what Ben did when he sent a smiling face with horns in just a second. This is KOSP. We'll be right back. This is Geekspeak. I'm Lyle Troxell with Ben Jaffe. Ben, you sent a smiling face with horns to a friend.
I sent a smiling face with horns, and my friend wrote back, he looks really angry. Angry. He's got horns, but he's smiling. He looks happy.
It didn't feel angry to you when
No, not at all. And so I wrote back, what do you mean? He's smiling. And she wrote, he's smiling. Like he's frowning. What are you talking about? He's frowning. And so I tried a couple different devices, and yes, indeed, smiling on one device, frowning on the rest. And in this case, it wasn't a bad thing. For me, it was just kind of an interesting, funny thing. But I can see how this could go very wrong. For example, the really, really happy guy versus the grimace. Someone sends a grimace and you get, oh, they're really happy about this. You know,
or they send a grimace and it's like, oh, I'm scared.
Yeah, like, it could be that. Yeah.
Fear, yeah.
Or like, hey, do you want to watch Titanic tonight? Grimace. Or smiling face. I mean, clearly there's going to be a discrepancy of opinion of what each person thinks the other person wants.
If all these pictures are the same, it would kind of work in the sense that if all the platforms showed them the same picture, the understanding of what it is would kind of get universal. But that they slightly vary, that becomes very difficult. You know, like the iOS people see one face and the Android people see a different face. That's weird. But also, doesn't it kind of produce a barrier of communication between those platforms?
I didn't think to go that far. That's a little philosophical, Lyle.
Sorry about that.
No, it's okay. I mean, there's always going to be some sort of discrepancy between the way that these get interpreted because there are different people in front of all these different screens, you know, and these people might have different cultural contexts or personal contexts. But if the devices have their own context, that kind of messes everything up.
That's a secondary problem, definitely. Mm-hmm. And so there's a whole study about this, the emoji and the communication methodology and what actually occurs from it.
This study goes deep.
Pretty deep.
It's long, but it's really kind of fun. They've got all these little graphs and the emoji on each platform that are most consistently misunderstood.
Oh, cool.
And most consistently understood. It's kind of
cool. The emoji interpretation. Did you hear do you ever watch the Colbert Report?
I did. It's not online. It's not anymore. It's the Late Show with Colbert.
The Late Show with Colbert. Sorry. Yes, that's right. Stephen Colbert, Late Show.
Okay.
So
you've been watching that?
I watched that.
Is it good?
Oh, yeah. I think it's great. I think it's a lot of fun. I mean, he played D&D as a kid, right? So right off the bat, you got to love him.
He is the biggest Lord of the Rings fan.
He's great.
It's amazing.
Great. Really good geek. In any case, he is famous for his eyebrow raise.
Oh, yeah.
And there is actually an eyebrow spec in the Unicode 10. There's an emoji which is face with one eyebrow raised, and the description of this on the platform is a face with a neutral straight mouth and a single eyebrow raised may be used to denote sarcasm, disbelief, or disapproval, and has been linked to the quizzical looks of Stephen Colbert. It currently raises the opposite eyebrow. Anyway, so that's kind of fun. So he made a whole thing about how there was going to be emoji named after him, basically.
Right. Of course.
Yeah. But yeah, this is the Unicode spec is a growing document. Right now, Unicode version 10, which is in preparation, February 9th, I think, which was the announced the candidates. It's a dumpling, a takeout box, chopsticks, fortune cookie, and face with one eyebrow raised. So there's a lot of discussion about which ones get added in, why, but it's pretty awesome. So there you go.
Wow.
Shall we go on with other news stories?
Since
we're doing that whole
what
thing?
What are we doing next?
I think that the Emojipedia document, the Wikipedia for emoji, the Emojipedia, has some problems because my browser is just kind of frozen at this point.
Oh, that sucks.
Let's go with...
should we go with patents?
Yeah, let's do patents.
This one's... Okay, this we one's a short one, but show. Oh my God, I love this story. Someone created a website called allpriorart.com. And this allpriorart.com basically generates fake patents. So, for example, let me read one to you. Number 14604248 and blah, 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 blah. It's this long SHA. A system for presenting an electronic programming guide in a media system is disclosed. One embodiment utilizes an accelerometer-based detector that presents a light load to the chest. It's sensitive to the desired high-frequency range, and blah, 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 blah. These are...
That's a patent?
Programmatically generated.
Oh.
They're fake.
Okay.
No human did this.
Wait, okay, let's describe... Wait, you've got to describe why this is useful.
Right. Okay. So there's this huge problem... there's the idea of a patent troll. Do you want to explain what that is?
Yeah, a patent troll basically is someone who buys – normally they buy a patent that's been already disclosed to the patent. And maybe it's gotten approval. Maybe it's not. But it describes something. And then they go
– They buy or they make one.
Yeah. Most of the time they buy these pre-existing patents that somebody filed at some point. But sometimes they make them. And that patent then kind of covers an idea. And then they go find people that are already doing that idea and they sue them for an amount of money that – isn't worth it to fight it. And so the first agency, let's say they get charged $1,000 for the ability to produce audio files downloaded on a mobile device. Okay, that's the patent. Mm-hmm. And so then the next company pays $1,000, the next company. And after a few years, it's really hard to fight it because they're collecting a lot of money, people are representing the patent, and they're suing people for it. Mm-hmm. And these things can be kind of annoying, and that's why we call them a troll. Okay, go on.
So just from the /dot description, basically, the system works by pulling text from the entire database of U.S. issued and published unapproved patents and creating prior art from the patent language. And while most inventions generated will be nonsensical, the cost to computationally create and publish millions of ideas is nearly zero.
Which is kind of the problem with patent, with the patent system in general.
So that allows for a higher probability of possible valid prior art. So the idea behind all of this is to preempt patent trolls.
Okay. So what you do is you randomly generate crazy ideas based off of words that already exist about technology. And when you then submit all those to the patent agency, or you just make them public. You just make them public. This is a crazy idea I had.
Here's some millions of crazy ideas.
And then 5 years later, when they do a search for prior art of that idea, they run into this document that describes the idea to a T.
Yeah.
It happens to be it's a really beautiful idea.
It's perfect.
I mean, from a software engineering perspective, we're really frustrated with these patents because normally, even though they seem like novel and creative, in reality, they're just the exact thing you would do if you had that problem, right? Like, that's probably one of the ideas about patents is they're supposed to be novel. It's supposed to take work to come up with the idea. But in reality, when you – a great example of this is the Amazon's one-click purchase button.
Right,
okay?
Yeah.
They have a patent on the ability to buy something with a one click. And that is silly because there's nothing unique about that. And there's tons of examples I can't get into here that basically they are the solution to the problem when you start thinking about the problem. And therefore they shouldn't be patentable because that's the solution. It's a simple solution.
Right. Yeah. There's also the famous one by Apple, which is patent number D670286, which is the patent which covers the outer edge shape of a device, a rectangle with rounded corners.
They have a patent for
rounded corner rectangle device.
Disgusting.
And yeah, right. that describes pretty much every
phone. Prior art generating tool sounds awesome.
Yes.
Hey, do you know about Senate Bill, the Feinstein, the Burr-Feinstein backdoor proposal bill?
I don't. Okay. I don't really follow that stuff very
okay.
critically.
So there is a bill in Congress right now, and I'll just read the EFF's action page because EFF is suggesting that you do something about it. You contact your representatives, and that's why I'm talking about it. And I'll just read there. Tell Congress stop the Burr-Feinstein backdoor proposal. A new proposal could be disastrous for the future of digital security. The language offered by the senators Burr and Feinstein would force tech companies to break the security of their products to make it easier for law enforcement to spy on people. Tell Congress today, oppose the Burr-Feinstein backdoor. And then basically EFF, the Electronic Freedom Foundation, produced a whole form where you put in your street address and your zip code. They tell you where to send it. In fact, you can modify the message that they've already pre-written mm-hmm. and send it, and it comes from you to your representative,
right.
which is awesome.
Right.
And of course, you know, talking to Congress directly is actually important in how they make decisions. And I mean, do you understand the we've talked a lot about the FBI Apple debate,
yeah.
and this is basically the legislation that would give the tools to law enforcement to do exactly what the FBI asked Apple to do legally. And the problem with these kind of backdoor ideas is that mathematically they break down and start making
right.
everything less secure.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. I don't want to go into a lot of detail of that, but I strongly believe that making laws that will stop companies from doing this will make those companies either do it in other countries where it's not illegal or force people that really want to have privacy to use system tools and such on top. And you're not really gaining a lot of support for law enforcement, unfortunately. At the end of
yeah,
this.
Yeah, that's a bad bill.
Yeah.
That's a bad, bad bill.
So we'll have that up at geekspeak.org, the action about that. Hey, every once in a while we talk about SpaceX and their successes and failures. What's up recently?
Yeah, do you remember when SpaceX tried to land a rocket on a floating barge?
I remember it fell over like a Tinker Toy.
And then
it was amazing.
It fell over yeah, and then yeah. the other time they tried it and it didn't work. And
they did it on land successfully once.
They did. They just succeeded landing on the floating drone ship.
And
which is
there's
awesome.
Video.
Yeah, it's an awesome video
it's
too.
Great.
It looked like very high winds. It comes in at this crazy kind of steep angle. It looks like, especially when you think about the scale of this thing, it's really, really, really tall. It's really big. And you look at the video and it's kind of a pulled back shot, at least the one that's being circulated a lot. But when you think about the scale of this is huge. This also would allow us to reuse these rockets, right? So they
right.
come down, we reuse the main parts of these rockets, the parts that are really expensive to produce, take time to produce. This means that we can get up to space and back down a lot more easily
awesome
and sustainability. So congrats to them. Also, if you look really closely when it lands, it actually bounces a little bit.
Oh, it does.
It bounces and it slides a little bit.
Totally reminds me of Lunar Lander. Every time I see it.
It's very bottom heavy. And so there are these big waves and the whole thing, the whole barge is rocking back and forth. And this thing is sticking up really tall. And so it's just leading back and forth. But because it's so bottom heavy, they don't have to worry about it too much.
That's cool.
They do, I think, weld the legs to the
as
to
soon
the barge
as possible.
when they send it back.
It's landed quick. Weld it
yeah,
down.
Right.
So also. Yeah, another success.
Also, Blue Origin, another company that's doing very similar things, they just stuck their third landing, which is really exciting as well. It's
awesome.
The same concept, same idea. A little bit different in the details, but serious, serious props to
space
all these teams.
So corporations succeeding to battle each other with success in space. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Hey, I've talked to you about Let's Encrypt before.
Yeah.
Right. This is this movement to make it really easy to have secure HTTPS on websites. And I researched it and looked into it. I'm not doing it for the geekspeak.org site, but the company I use for hosting on my personal sites like lyle.troxel.com, things like that, is a company called DreamHost. And DreamHost, you go up there, you have an account, and then you can add free domains for a long period of time. Going through their web interface after they implemented Let's Encrypt, which was an EFF project, by the way.
EFF, super good guys.
Yeah, awesome.
I love them.
I was able to just click a button saying enable SSL on this web form, and 20 minutes later, my website was supported with SSL. It was
SSL.
So easy.
SSL,
secure
what's
socket
that?
Layer. So when you visit your bank and there's like a little lock symbol in your browser, it
yeah,
says
the
it's
little
secure.
Green lock thing.
That. Now, there's different levels of this. This is the earliest level, but really awesome. Well, WordPress... I'm sorry, you were going to say?
Oh, yeah. I was just going to give it a little more context in case you haven't heard about it. It's the thing that prevents me from trying to talk to my bank, which is over there, and Lyle sitting in between and snooping on my Wi-Fi traffic,
that's
or
right.
the government sitting in between and grabbing those packets as they're going from data center to, from router to router along a backbone somewhere.
And the secure sockets layer, it means it's a layer on top of the your browser uses. Early on, we didn't put that everywhere because there was a few different issues. One is you had to authenticate. You had to figure out who Ben was and who the bank was early on.
Yeah,
and
it's,
that
it's
cost
hard
some money.
Stuff.
Yeah. And then also on top of that, there was some processing time that the browser and the server had to do.
It's slower.
And over time, our machines have gotten faster, so that's not a problem. And mm-hmm. the Let's Encrypt thing has made it really cheap to add these things.
Right.
Cool.
Cheap and easy.
Cheap
so,
and easy.
So even someone like you or me, even someone like we're web developers, and yet the idea of going and figuring out how to do this, it's kind of daunting, right?
Yeah.
But now there are tools that make it often a click away.
Now, you've heard of WordPress.
WordPress. What's that?
WordPress is a very popular browsing tool. It's a content management system.
Blogging tool. Yeah.
Sorry, blogging tool. A content management system, and people can whip up a website and launch it on WordPress on multiple places because it's an open source project. But there's also a company called WordPress, which does
right.
most of the development on it, and you can host through them, and they offer different features. WordPress.com on April 8th said, "Hey, everybody, anybody that's hosted through us, now your website is secure, HTTPS." So that's
wow.
cool. And that's a massive amount of people's
websites.
What
do I have to do?
You don't have to do diddly. If you're hosting with them, it just works. It's
it
awesome.
It just works.
Just awesome.
Wow. That's fantastic.
We'll have one more little update from Mr. Jaffe in just a second. But first, I want to let you know that GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. So use our stuff any way you'd like it. Just let them know the geek said hi. Feel free to tell people that you listen to GeekSpeak. We'd like to spread the word. You can do so by writing a review on your podcasting software recommendation, blah, blah, blah. I highly recommend trying to do that on iTunes and let people know you like it and share it around. Get more audience. This is Independent Public Radio 88.9 Santa Cruz and streaming live worldwide at kosp.org. To find out more about this or any episode, just visit geekspeak.org. And of course, you can email us, geeks@geekspeak. Thanks to our intern Chandler, our support geek Greg Merkley, Michael Newman of Pet Star Music for our theme song, and thank you very much for being here for episode 15 of our 16th season. You got a quick out?
I didn't, but I found one. Actually, this is kind of a fun one. Kepler, which is a satellite that's floating around Earth and looking at all the stars to try and find planets going around
yes,
all those other stars,
finder.
Exoplanets, right? Apparently, this troubled me to hear that it went into emergency mode, which meant that there was some kind of a problem, and they were a little worried about it. They did some diagnostics and all that stuff, and thank goodness they managed to get it back, and now it's recovered and doing its normal thing again.
That's the great kind of emergency, when it's already solved by the
time
you hear
yeah.
about it.
Like, oh, my favorite satellite's in peril. Oh, it's okay?
Oh, good.
You awesome. Still get the adrenaline rush.
Definitely. Hey, thanks, Ben.
Yeah, thank you so much, Lon.
That was fun.
Cool.
Did you want to cover any other stories? I guess we ran out, literally.
We ran out of
stories. I didn't know that I took your story. I didn't know it was yours.
There's also that SpaceX delivered the first inflatable room to the International Space Station. That was part of their payload.
An inflatable room?
An inflatable room.
I'm assuming that it doesn't go inside, it goes
no,
outside?
No. They're going to go camping. That'd
so,
be fun.
So it's going to be an addition to the space station?
It's an addition, yeah. It's going to connect up to the space station. It's going to be the size of a small bedroom, this little module that sticks
and
out.
And it's blow up.
And it's a blow up room, yeah.
Isn't that like dangerous?
It feels terrifying.
I guess space is dangerous. That's just how it
yeah,
works.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't really know how that works. What if you hurdled yourself against the edge and like
it's
would that
probably
would be,
pretty strong
it's yeah. probably really strong but still that would feel
I think
terrifying.
Though if there's an emergency you get out of that room.
Oh yeah that's true.
Did you hear about the Fitbit guy?
The Fitbit guy?
So one man's Fitbit device proved to be much smarter than a pedometer. A 42-year-old man in New Jersey suffered from a seizure at work and in the emergency room the Fitbit was used to understand what the guy's heart had been doing.
Oh, he had a Fitbit H. Actually, I have one right here.
But you're not wearing it.
I took
what
it
if you
off
have a seizure, dude?
It was bothering my wrist when we were doing the recording. But yeah, actually, I guess I'm a really bad Fitbit HR owner. HR for heart rate. I turned off the heart rate feature because it saves the battery and it lasts a lot longer. But that's really cool.
Right. So what happened is upon the arrival at the Our Lady of Lourdes Medical Center in Camden.
They have such epic names.
The doctors noticed that the person after the seizure had an atrial fibrillation, right? So the beat was not regular.
Yeah.
Arterial fibrillation. And it was irregular and fast heartbeat, basically. And they didn't know if that was the normal condition for this person, because it could have been.
Yeah.
Or it could have been caused by the seizure. And so knowing the detail of that would be really important in treating this person, because one, if it's totally not normal, you'd want to shock the heart to get the heart back into beat.
But if it's normal, you don't want to mess with it. Yeah,
right, exactly. So it also could possibly cause another stroke if you fibrillated them.
Oh,
when you didn't
wow.
need to.
Okay.
So that's when they looked at the Fitbit and were able to figure out what his heart had been doing.
So I guess they got into his phone, opened up the Fitbit app, and looked at his baseline heart rate.
Yep, that's exactly what they did. They took a look at the smartphone. And the thing is, you know, if you did have if you had an anomaly in your heartbeat, you might denote it by having a band around your wrist, but you might not, right? Like you could wear a medical ID thing, but it's also possible you wouldn't. But when you have a piece of technology on you that everyone knows what it does, it becomes really clear. Oh, yeah, definitely a good thing to do. Anyway, this helped. You know, maybe it didn't help save the life. Maybe it wouldn't have mattered. But it did help them diagnose the problem better.
It gave them another point of data.
Yep.
And that's important. You know, and although headlines can be you know, kind of, I don't know, intense, I guess, it may have actually saved his life, yeah, maybe.
So it revealed a baseline pulse rate of 70 to 80 beats per minute with an immediate persistent increase to a range of 140, 160 at the approximate time of the patient's seizure. Mm-hmm. And therefore, they knew what they had to do.
Wow.
Pretty cool.
That's cool.
Awesome.
Do we have anything else? Or? No.
We're in post shows. We can do a talk.
We're in post
shows.
So, Star Trek. someone wrote in and was like, I loved that Star Trek discussion. And
keep
that
in mind,
just,
one person wrote
one
in.
One person wrote in. All I need is one data point. No one wrote in and grumbled at us, so that was nice.
That's good.
I actually don't have anything to say about Star Trek right now, which
you
is
don't?
Rare.
Have you seen the new Star Wars trailer?
Actually, I don't. Star Wars. I don't know,
God, I'm just trying.
I'm not a Wars fan. I don't like war.
But you like Deep Space Nine. There's a lot of conflict in Deep Space Nine. See
actually,
earlier show.
Actually, I do have something to share, which is that at Facebook, we've got all of these different conference rooms, and they all have different names. And a lot of them are puns and things. I'll catch up with you later. Catch up spelled like the condiment. There's a again. Netflix has that too. No, Netflix has movie names, huh?
Movies and television shows and movies. Our old building had like a floor that was sitcoms, like I Love Lucy and the classic sitcoms. This building we're in, there's three stories, and then the building next has two stories, and each of them are continents. And so I think currently we might be in Australia right now. I'm not really sure.
Okay.
And then each of the rooms is named after a movie or a television show that's kind of well-known from that region.
I guess you don't run out of that kind of material.
I guess
people
not.
Keep making these.
This is awesome. This one doesn't have a lot of good pictures, but some of the rooms have these great pictures from the films.
Uh-huh.
It's awesome.
So at Facebook, there is a large cluster of rooms, and all of these rooms that are adjacent to each other are different Star Trek alien species.
Do you set all your meetings there?
If only. It's on the other side of the longest building. So, I don't. But, so there's Cardassian and there's Romulan and there's Q.
Wait, are the Romulans and the Cardassians near each other?
Yeah. I mean, they're all...
genetically, they're very close.
No, they're not. No, Romulans and Vulcans.
Oh, Vulcans. Sorry. Oh, my
gosh.
Oh,
you're
my
embarrassing
God.
Me.
I'm so sorry.
But there's also the room Klingon. So, when a team wants to launch a feature, they'll basically take over a conference room.
And stay there for a while.
Yeah, and it's called a war room.
Mm-hmm. We have those.
Right. So a team that I work with some of the time took over Klingon as their war room.
Nice.
And Klingons are, of course, the species that are very into battle and honor and you know, today
is
a good day to
die. What's the project they're working on there?
I actually don't know.
Oh, I just love if it was like this really peaceful, pleasant thing.
Right,
like find your closest flower shop is the project, and it's like Klingon War Room.
So I went online and I found there's a really beautiful and kind of fierce looking war like logo for the Klingon species, mm-hmm. and it shows up everywhere. And so I bought a bunch of decals.
You stuck them in the room?
And I stuck them all over the room. I stuck them on the glass door. And another coworker
and I were...
So you
feel comfortable doing that at Facebook, like where you've just been working for 4 months?
Yeah.
That's the kind of environment it is.
Yeah. People talk about hacking all the time. You know, like hackathons, get up and go and hack on something you don't know about or something with another team or something.
So it's a learning experience place.
It's a learning experience place. It's a, you know, just within reason, go do stuff. Go do stuff that seems like a good idea. And, you know, obviously be sensitive when it is important to be sensitive. But so, for something like this, I mean, whatever. You know, people can take them down. It's fine.
Yeah, that's cool.
Actually, I'd be upset. I'd be a little upset.
The thing is, I'm not very surprised. I mean, we have the same kind of feeling here. You can kind of do what makes sense.
Yeah, it's right? a kind of a hacker culture.
Yeah, definitely. But it is interesting that seemed fine to do that.
Like, I feel like Netflix has a little bit more of a refined culture. It's like,
I think so.
It's at Netflix, everyone is adults.
Yes.
At Facebook,
we're
all
children.
Young adults.
Well, it could be that you know me and I work here and I'm older than you. It might be just that.
Well,
that's the same age as you that works here.
No, yeah. I think it's...
I agree that we're a little more responsible in the...
There's a perception of responsibility, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't know
it's
if
it's one of our mottos.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
freedom and responsibility is like the only motto we have. Freedom and responsibility. We're supposed to be really responsible and free to do anything we want.
So, I feel like I'm clearly an adult at this point, but I really kind of feel like I'm a kid still trapped in an adult's body. So I've gotten better and better and better.
To me, you'll always be a kid.
stop it. Just stop it. You and Miles haven't made fun of my age for ages.
You know, the thing is,
I'm not all that younger than both of you.
As a parent, I'm a bit of an ageist in the sense that I don't really think you're an adult until you have a child. And I know that's completely ridiculous.
What if I don't have a child?
Yeah. Sucks to be you.
I'm always a kid.
At some point, you'd be... Yeah, no. I think if he was an adult, of course.
Peter Pan thing, that's fine.
I think that one of the... There's the stages in life that are pretty substantial, right? That moving out from your parents' place.
Yeah, right.
Right? A parent dying.
Right.
Big thing.
Right.
And any close death is a big changing point.
Yeah, I'd say a close death.
Having a child. I think getting married is to some degree that, but of course the ceremony itself, but partnering with somebody and actually trying to figure out your life with somebody else is a big turning point. And I think then your kids moving out maybe. Those stages are big. Now, of course, not everyone has all those stages. Right?
Dying is a pretty big stage too.
I would say that's not a big stage in your life. That's a big stage in other people's lives.
Me dying. Eventually I will die.
That'll dying. Is
no,
not a big thing in your life.
That'll be the end of a stage.
It has no. It's not a stage.
I do think about my mortality.
Good.
Quite a bit. Yeah.
You must be an adult.
Thank you. So,
what happens?
Is this again?
I don't know.
Geek Speak, right?
I don't know. It's interesting because when we have this freedom of doing, like when we used to record, when we used to do the show live,
right?
We right after us was a music show. We had to get out of the room in like 3 minutes. You get out of the room in 3 minutes, and now you know, 15 years or something like that of doing that very, very specific live, no editing. This is the time you're on. This is the time you're off, and it's over. There's something very nice about that. I mean, I like that because then you leave the station, you're done. Now I edit the show afterwards, whatever.
Are you saying you're not enjoying this conversation?
No, what I'm saying here is this has always been my fear of a podcast versus a radio show. A radio show is strict time.
You have a clear length, 53 or 56 minutes or whatever it is.
And we've built our audience off of that.
Right.
And then we now have this post-show thing. We can do whatever we want and we can potentially ramble on. You should have heard last week. Oh my gosh, we kept on going. But maybe it was 2 weeks ago. But the thing that I find interesting is I enjoy this part of the conversation so much because I feel like there's a little bit lack of less responsibility on – you know, people could just turn off for the theme song. You know, when we end the show, they can just turn off. They don't have to keep on listening to the post show.
Oh, yeah. So if you're still listening, you're welcome to.
And early on, I was kind of like – I kept on asking people, do you like this kind of thing? Should we keep doing this? And now I'm thinking, you know what? I'm going to do it. Some people will like it. Some people won't. And that's fine. Just stop listening early on. You know?
That's awesome.
Anyway. No more Star Trek?
No more Star Trek? No. I'm done. That's it.
Yeah, we're good.
Actually, one more thing. Unfortunately, we have to move war rooms. That's a bummer.
Are you in the Klingon war room?
I am not in the Klingon war room, but I sometimes work closely with several people who are on that team doing that thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I feel comfortable walking by and dropping in and saying hi.
You know, have you even talked about what you actually do at Facebook?
I haven't.
Okay, we'll do that sometime in the future.
That sounds good. Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right. See you next week.
See you.